Buffon, and then Ronaldo! Oh! What a goal by Cristiano Ronaldo!
Messi to the near post! Messi to the net!
Mamma mia! Lionel!
Ramel Kiyoko now. Here's a Honduran. He'll whip it in back to the far post. Elise! Albert Elise! La Pantarita! It's a Honduran connection!
This is Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN975.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5. That's 1 hour in the books right there. That was a good hour. Amazing stuff there from producer Mike Cohn, who's worked on Olympics, World Cups, Doug Wren, who's directed World Cups and North American Soccer League. I mean, these guys have helped shape the television and soccer industry in the United States. So second hour is also presented, as you just heard there, by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. John and his personal injury attorneys are going to bring you a personalized approach. DaspitLaw.com, 713-322-HURT. They are bilingual. Look, nobody wants to get in an accident. You get in a fender bender. You get in a car accident, motorcycle, industrial. You might work in a plant, refinery, drive an 18-wheeler. The Daspit Law Firm is going to have you covered. They'll work for you 24-7 nights and weekends, and then you'll get the representation you need at the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. John and his firm, big soccer fans. They also are the presenting sponsor of our show tomorrow night in Austin at 7 o'clock. So we'll be on the air in Austin tomorrow. Tonight's Houston. This could be, from the standpoint of seriousness, this is the most serious interview here tonight. I'm bringing on my nephew here in a minute. I asked him if it would be okay if he'd come on. He's 4-plus weeks into having tested positive to the coronavirus. Not initially, but once he got tested positive. He's tested twice now, if I'm correct, and he'll correct me. But my nephew Khan is going to come on now, and we're going to talk a little bit about kind of his experiences now with the coronavirus. Khan, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. So first I'm going to ask you simply, how are you feeling at this moment?
You know, I'm a little anxious to be on such a big radio show that I've been trying to get on for about 10 years. But apparently I had to get a rare disease to be asked on. So I'm a little nervous, but other than that, I'm feeling okay.
Yeah, don't be nervous. You're going to more than handle this. But let's get focused here, and let's just kind of get from you a little bit of the scenario to give my listeners kind of take us through how this all happened, where you've been, where you are now, to the point of tonight talking to me on this radio show.
Sure. So I live and work primarily in New York City. I go back to the islands where I'm from often, to the U.S. Virgin Islands. But I've been in New York primarily for quite a while. And, you know, I was asked by some friends of mine that I assist with their business if I would come with them on a trip to Italy during Milan Fashion Week, which was February 20th to the 24th. You know, so I was there for about 4 days, and they put on some large events. And I went to a number of events and dinners and parties and whatnot. You know, Milan is a fantastic city, as you know, and Fashion Week is a very, very busy time. It's probably the busiest week of the year in Milan. So you've literally got people from all over the world descending on the city, and you've got events with, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 people at some of these events. And I was there for 3 days, and on the third night, I believe, the third or fourth night, it was announced that there were about 6 cases 30 minutes outside of Milan. You know, this would have been a Saturday night. And obviously we knew what was going on. Well, we didn't know what was going on. We still don't in China. But we had an idea of what was happening in China and more so in South Korea. Cases were popping up here and there. But it was still relatively fresh end of February. You know, so Sunday, the following day, Sunday, everything was dead. The city basically came to a halt in a very impressive way. I mean, people immediately socially distanced and shut down on their own. They didn't need to be told anything by the government. It was very impressive. Unfortunately, it's obvious that, you know, the virus had already, you know, really planted its seeds in days and weeks prior, you know, because the explosion of the number of cases really took off. You know, but I left on Monday, and at that point there were about six cases. You know, and we were all a little bit concerned, but, you know, six cases, 30 minutes away, you know, they're 3-4 days, it doesn't really hit too close to home. You know, about one out of five people in the airport were wearing masks. You know, I boarded an A380 Airbus large plane with about 800 passengers capacity. And we went directly back to New York. You know, upon landing in New York, there were no protocols. When we landed in Milan, they checked everyone's temperature, you know, with a scanner from a distance. And that was prior to the outbreak. When we landed in JFK, you know, there were no protocols. There was nothing going on. I kind of later, you know, joked about it in a regard. It was the fastest I ever got through an international line at JFK ever. It took like 10 minutes to go through and get my bags. It was almost bizarre. You know, and then I went into my office in the morning the next day. I work, you know, in investment banking in a boutique firm. Luckily, not a lot of employees, and I have my own private office. And by the end of the day, the number of cases had gone to 50, I think. And at that point, I luckily hadn't seen anybody other than one guy. And I went home and I self-quarantined from then on. You know, so that's. So that's kind of how it started for me. I went over and I had a sniffle and a cold, and I came back and I had a sniffle and a cold. And I'll get back to that kind of later. But, you know, over the next week, I was basically staying home and felt okay. You know, I was playing basketball in my gym by myself downstairs in a large apartment building. And, you know, it was very much business as usual. I didn't feel off. About a week later, 7 to 10 days after getting back, I had some chills, didn't feel great, felt off for about 2 days, never, you know, really registered a temperature, And then on, it would have been Saturday the 7th of March, I got news that a good friend of mine who was also in Milan that I had met up with twice, had gotten whacked with COVID, which turned into pneumonia, and he was in a coma in Brooklyn. And he's same age as me, you know, roughly 35. You know, no pre-existing stuff. It turns out that his case got very severe, and they had to induce a coma in order for him to you know, take a breathing tube and be on a respirator. Thankfully, he recovered and is out of the hospital and doing well. But that was on a Saturday that I gained that news. And then on a Sunday, I called ahead. I went to urgent care. I let them know I was coming and because that kind of was what the protocol was at the time. And I went in, you know, to give you an idea. This is February 8th. I'm sorry, March 8th. So things were quite different then in New York. I you know, I was treated more or less as a leper at the door. You know, they freaked out. They put me in a room. Doctor came in, you know, full gown, face guards, the rest of it. It was very obvious that I was probably the first case that they had seen or potential case. And long story short there, you know, I went back to my apartment and I returned with a positive test 5-6 days later. You know, the New York City Department of Health was supposed to call me daily and check in twice a week. You know, this is 30 days later. I've never received one call from the Department of Health in New York, or any guidance, really, to be honest. You know, so I stayed home and I was on quarantine, for about a week to 10 days. And at 10 days, and then at that point, one evening, I was struggling to breathe. I didn't feel great. Went into the New York Presbyterian downtown in Manhattan. And similar scenarios, I was one of the first 50 cases in Manhattan, which is kind of like winning the reverse lottery, I guess. So it was kind of an anomaly initially, or a bit of a novelty, but not so much anymore. So I went in, and similar scenario. They were very, very forceful in the way that, you know, I was processed, because you're literally a ticking time bomb. And then I was consulted with doctors with, you know, hazmat suits and air, breathing systems and the rest of it. And they gave me, a chest scan. They checked all my vitals. My vitals were all more or less normal. My heart rate was kind of 85-ish, you know, oxygen 97 to 99. So all within acceptable parameters. And they scanned my chest and found that, you know, I had, pneumonia. Now, there's a lot going on regarding pneumonia and how they're classifying this, and I'm not a doctor or a medical professional, but from what I've read and all the doctors that I've spoken to, this is a pneumonia of sorts that they have not seen before in the way that it, you know, infiltrates and attacks the lungs and all sorts of people. I grew up in the Virgin Islands, free diving and spearfishing, and I can hold my breath, you know, 4+ minutes and dive 125 feet. I don't smoke. I had no pre-existing, issues. And I was dunking a basketball before and after I came back from Milan. So I'm not exactly, you know, a person with the risk factors that you would think would have a hard time with something like this, which was why I initially kind of became public on Facebook and Instagram and with people, because it was very much being designated as kind of an old folks disease. And if you're, you know, obese or have pre-existing conditions, you know, or 65 plus, you might have a hard time. You know, the reality is I don't fit that demographic in any regard. And I got hammered by it. I'm still dealing with it a month later. It's definitely an interesting disease, because we're in the infancy of learning about it. So quite often the doctors are going to have, you know, more questions for you than they have answers, because you're, you know, in some regards, a bit of a guinea pig. They know a lot more in South Korea and Italy and other places than they do here, because they've been treating it and dealing with it for 3-4 more weeks, or 8 more weeks in the case of Asia. But they're still learning a lot. So I think for anyone that gets diagnosed, you know, every case is different. All symptoms are different. I didn't have a temperature. It didn't hit me that hard. What they did find when I got checked out with all my blood work was that I had rhinoenterovirus in my system also, which is what approximately 50% of all upper respiratory cold flu-ish things are. So when I had a cold and I went to Italy and came back, I was kind of fighting that already. So my theory is, and their theory is, that, you know, I likely had a slightly weakened immune system because of that, and that may have been why the coronavirus, festered and attacked my lungs. But I don't know that. I've been on, like, house arrest now, so between myself, quarantine, and this, I haven't seen anybody other than my doorman and doctors since the end of February, which in itself is I think, going to be challenging for a lot of people. If you couple that with the anxiety surrounding a rare disease and not being able to get many answers, and a difficult time breathing, you know, that combination can be very, very challenging for people. I've never had anxiety issues. I've been a trader and made and lost a lot of money. I've ride motorcycles. I like risky stuff, generally speaking. And I've never had anxiety issues in my life. But when you're, you know, when you're alone, which I've been for, you know, many weeks, and you are having a hard time breathing, and you can't sleep, and you're told come back to the hospital if you can't breathe, you know, it can play games on your psyche and in your mind, as far as, you know, what's a symptom, what's anxiety, what's going on. Mm-hmm. you know, and ultimately I landed in the hospital in the ER three times over the course of a month. You know, they basically told me my normal lung capacity and size is probably 125%, so 25% more than most people because of my training. And that's likely what saved me from a respirator and further problems, just because at my, you know, reduced rate, I was still at a good level.
Cons, stick with me. Yep. Stick with me. Hold that thought. We got to go to a commercial break. We'll come back. We'll wrap up the interview. I got one or two quick questions for you when we come back. This has been great testimony. Stay with me. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More Con Davis here talking coronavirus.
This is Nolan Ryan. You're listening to Houston's Best Sports Talk, ESPN 97.5.
You are listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to the show. We continue on here. Again, my nephew, Con Davis, joining us on the show from New York City. He has tested positive twice for the coronavirus, giving us some very good information here, continuing to fight it. He's going to beat this. There's no question about that. And we're very glad that he's on the show. Con, I want you to go take us back to where you were before we went to break on kind of the loneliness side of it, the anxiety side of it, because many people are having that problem without having the coronavirus. You have the virus, and it's easy for your mind to begin to play tricks on you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that everyone is different in terms of their own psyche, what they've been through, what their experiences are, you know, their capacity to manage different things. So I think it's kind of a gut check, and I think it's a different experience for different people. You know, but if you look at the prison system, one of the ways that they punish prisoners and have for years is by putting people in solitary confinement without human interaction. You know, we're social beings. We're used to being around people. It's bizarre and odd to be isolated by yourself without any human contact for weeks. You know, I think that there are a lot of things that we have now in terms of FaceTime, in terms of internet and texting and TVs and whatnot, and things that you can do at home to try to combat that. You know, for me, it was not difficult for a while. Then it got difficult. Then it got easier. You know, it's challenging. I mean, I think that for anybody that's out there, what you can expect is, there's limited testing available in most places, most states and municipalities. So, you know, if you don't have a temperature of 103 and above and you don't have a difficulty breathing, you might not get a test. What they're going to tell you if you go to the hospital is go home, rest, and they're going to effectively, you know, tell you to treat it like a normal flu. Until you get to an elevated position where the risks are, in their opinion, more significant, they're not going to keep you in the hospital. You know, so if you can handle it at home and manage it at home and not, you know, clog up the hospital, I think that's the right thing to do. But at the same rate, if you're having issues and you know your body, go in, let them know you're coming and go in and get checked out. You know, I tested positive actually three times. The first time was on the 8th. The second time was, I think, on the 13th, when I had to go back to the hospital, they insisted on testing because mine was.
Yeah, explain
lab.
That. Explain that, because some people get confused the fact that you've been tested twice. So I think you were just about
tested,
to get us
I've been
there.
Tested three times. First time I was tested, I was one of the early ones, so the tests weren't as finite as they are now. The second time I was in the emergency room, and they effectively wouldn't take my word for it that I was positive. They needed verification, so they gave me a test even knowing that I had already tested positive. The third time was when I got tested to hopefully be cleared, which was a week ago yesterday, so 22 days after my first test. and I still tested positive. According to the government, I haven't had symptoms for quite some time, nor have I been infectious. You know, they've kind of been moving the markers on quarantines and whatnot. Now, in most places, it's, you know, 72 hours with no fever and no major symptoms. You know, you're cleared. Even with doctors and nurses in Albany, New York, and in New York, they're being sent back to work within 3 to 5 days, a week of recovering, quote unquote, recovering from coronavirus. Now, they're not retesting, because if they did, many of these people would fail. They're just saying that they're no longer infectious. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. So I've taken all the precautions and continue to not see people out of an abundance of caution. I think we've learned through this whole thing that the government doesn't have all the answers, nor do healthcare providers. So, you know, do the right thing, do the smart thing, stay at home, correct, avoid people in general if you can. And if you think you're symptomatic, even if you're asymptomatic, you should be taking these things, these precautions, because the numbers kind of play out like out of 100 people that are positive, 80% are not going to need, 80 to 90% are not going to need major health care. Many of that 80 to 90% aren't even going to have symptoms that they notice, but they could be passing this along. So, you know, from a responsibility perspective, I think people just need to, you know, assume that, like they say with gun safety, like treat everything like a loaded gun. Treat yourself like you have it. Avoid other people until things really slow down.
All right. We're talking to Con Davis. He's my nephew. He's in New York City. He's still battling the coronavirus, COVID-19. So I want to take you into now. And by the way, tremendous respect from your uncle here for you having concern and care for others. I've always known you were that kind of guy. But the fact that you've isolated is phenomenal. And I don't even want to get into what I see sometimes here in Houston when it comes to people not respecting each other by staying away and doing things that they shouldn't be doing. But we're not going to go there. But I want to talk about now the medication that you're on. And how that's working, because it's still in some ways very experimental.
So I, as soon as I got this and it was kind of made public to friends and family and others, I had several calls from concerned friends with capabilities abroad, medical capabilities or run healthcare systems or whatnot, from Israel, from Korea, from Senegal, from Italy. And it was a common thing. This was 4 weeks ago. Chloroquine, hydrochloroquine, chloroquine. Take that with zinc or erythromycin. This was told to me a month ago. So, you know, I don't want to get into the politics of it and the politicized nature of healthcare right now. I think it's disgusting, frankly. This is a national emergency, and it's impacting people of every, you know, creed, color, political affiliation. I can only provide a testimonial on my experience. Chloroquine is an FDA approved drug. There's no reason why a doctor cannot prescribe it legally. You know, should they deem it to be viable for a case, as far as I know. You know, it's been around for 20 years. It's an anti-malaria drug primarily. I believe it's used with lupus and some other things. You know, they didn't initially give it to me because they looked at me and said, you know, we think you're going to do well with your immune system and the rest of it. Fight it naturally. Well, after 3+ weeks and having chest issues and not resolving the pneumonia-ish stuff, you know, they said, what do you think? And I said, I'll take it, because I was still having trouble breathing. My heart rate was elevated. Normally, my resting heart rate is probably 65. My resting heart rate was more like 82, 85 to 105, depending on what was going on. And I began taking this on Saturday, a combination of 400 milligrams a day, 200 and 200, and erythromycin, hydrochloroquine and erythromycin. And within 2 hours, I felt a noticeable difference in terms of the heaviness of my chest alleviating, my breaths being deeper. I've been able to sleep 5 to 7 hours a night, which is more. I was generally sleeping about 3 hours at a time. And for me, I can notice a tremendous difference. I'm hopefully at the tail end of this thing, and hopefully this knocks it out. I can't speak for others, and I'm not a medical professional, but my personal opinion is, you know, the president said, "What do you have to lose?" And I think that struck a lot of chords with people for different reasons. When you go into the healthcare system and you have this, they don't have anything to provide you with other than Tylenol, fluids, and vitamins. You really don't have another option currently that I know of, and I haven't been provided any other options. So if it's accelerating, this is kind of your shot in terms of taking anything. Some of the side effects can be very gnarly and harsh. I've been dealing with that. It's a heavy drug, that's for sure. I wouldn't take it if I didn't need to.
You said headaches and nauseousness?
Some headaches.
Is some of the side effect?
Yeah, some headaches, some nauseousness. You can literally like feel it going through your system. Kind of feels like I got hit by a truck. I haven't taken it tonight. I wanted to wait till after the interview to give you an idea. Right. You know, so it's. But the way I look at it, I'm taking it till Sunday. And, you know, it's one day at a time. And after Sunday, I'm done with it. So that's my perspective. If you don't need to go to the ER or you don't need hydrochloroquine, I wouldn't do either of them. But if you're having substantial issues, you have to be aware that this thing can spiral out of control in your body very quickly. You know, you can go from having mild chest issues to being constrained to the point where you can't breathe, to being on a respirator, to being no longer in a period of days or hours in some cases.
And that's happened.
It's a serious thing, you know, and it's not all old people, not all people with, you know, pre-existing conditions, and they have more questions than answers. So, you know, ask a lot of questions, and, you know, as the old adage is, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I was talking to a friend about this, and my response was, no, a pound of prevention, and hopefully you'll get an ounce of cure if you get it. Mm-hmm. Because there, you know, there is no quote unquote cure yet, right? So take a pound of prevention, take every precaution you possibly can not to get it, not to end up in the ER. It's a horrible experience. I mean, I feel lucky. I feel fortunate. I have no complaints. You know, but I was sitting next to a gentleman the other day, FaceTiming and talking to his kids and his wife. And I'm hopeful that he's okay, but it did not look like it was going the right direction. And he was being moved upstairs to be on a ventilator, and he had all kinds of issues. He's not going to see his wife and family until he recovers. You can take no visitors. If you're dying, you can take no visitors. You know, it's a very serious thing. It's not like, you know, it's not like many other horrible diseases, you know, where you're very infectious. You don't see anyone. So, you know, you don't want to end up in that situation psychologically, physically, under any circumstances. And, you know, I'd love to see no one else end up in that situation. And that's why I spoke out. But that's also why I've shared my experience, because there are lots of people that are and will be in that situation, unfortunately. You know, so that's kind of my journey so far. I've watched the healthcare system evolve because I've been there 3 times, 2 hospitals. And I was one of the first 50 cases, and now you've got, you know, I would say probably 1 million infected persons in the tri-state area or more. But I think there's about 180 or something thousand validated cases. You know, it's a tough one. It's an equalizer. It hits everybody. It doesn't matter who you are. You can be a celebrity. You could be the guy on the street. You could be anybody. You know, take precautions for yourself, for your family, for your community. And you know, this era, you said you wouldn't speak about, you know, what you're seeing in Houston. I'll take the opportunity to say, I see people in New York running around. I mean, this is ground zero for the globe right now. And I see 70% of the people jogging down the highway across from my apartment have no protection on. A lot of the people walking do. Most people are staying away, but not all. It's insane, frankly. I mean, the behavior is
so disrespectful. Yeah, and it's so disrespectful. I mean, that's
the majority.
One thing you can do for your fellow humans is stay away from them. I mean,
yeah, it's not a and I think when you know I think there are a lot of people that are dealing with different issues. There are people that have preconditions. There are people that have depression. You know, so I understand why people need to get out, go for a walk, have air, just do everything that you can to be safe about it. You know, and economically, financially, health wise. I don't think this is a sprint in any capacity. I think it's a marathon. And I think people need to prepare themselves for a marathon. You know, don't come out of the gates running 100 miles an hour and expect this to last if you get it or if you're stuck on quarantine or whatever it may be, you know, for 9 seconds.
Con, listen, 26
miles.
This is a great way to end it. You just called it not a sprint, it's a marathon. Listen, what you've done tonight, I think, has done a tremendous amount of great educational stuff. This has been a very, very good interview. There's a lot in there for people to think about. I really want to let you know how much I respect you for making sure that you've stayed isolated. The fact that you're speaking out about this, continue to do that. I think it's helpful for a lot of people. And thank you so much for coming on the program tonight. I will check in with you tomorrow. I hope you get a nice, restful night of sleep.
Thanks, Glenn. I learned from the best, man. I see what you've done for Kicks for Cancer for all these years. And, you know, much respect there.
Well, your uncle's worried about you, but he knows at the end of this, you're gonna win this thing. You're going to get back to health. And again, my listeners are going to thank you, and so am I. Love you, buddy, and I will talk to you tomorrow.
Be safe. Bye.
All right. That's my nephew. Pretty incredible kid. Whew. That's a little bit haunting. It's not going to be easy to do an interview with Darwin Seren next, but we're going to do that. We're going to take a break. That was my nephew, Con Davis. Heed some of the seriousness in that. That did not sound pretty, but it also was a great dose of reality. Take a break. Nick Sherrara, producer, takes us to break here. This show presented by John Daspit, the Daspit Law Firm.
This is Nolan Ryan. You're listening to Houston's best sports talk, ESPN 97.5.
You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to Soccer Matters. Great job, Nick Sherrara, in studio here producing tonight. I have to be honest with you. It's tough to continue on with this radio show after listening to your nephew talk about the dark side of this coronavirus. On the other hand, I think there's a real sense of reality in there, and he laid it out quite well. Hope a lot of people heard that, because this is not a joke. Even though some people still think they're going to defy just being respectful to each other. Okay, so last segment here, looking forward to this interview with Darwin Seren. Still a little bit shaken up here. Darwin Seren, Houston Dynamo, also has been the captain of El Salvador's national team, and Darwin joins us now. Darwin, how are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Darwin, thanks so much for coming on the program. And I first just want to ask, how are you and your family doing right now, you know, being at home, and how's everything going for you personally with your family?
It's like, you know, it's a difficult moment, as we know, for now in the country and in the world. So it's time to spend a beautiful time with the family. I think I have 4 kids, and it's a lot of work in the home, but I really enjoy it because sometimes when we play, and we play especially when we go away, so you miss some time with your family, So now is a beautiful opportunity to recover this time.
Talking to midfielder Darwin Serén of the Houston Dynamo right now. Darwin, does this kind of make football secondary in the moment? You know, football is such a part of your life. It's your passion. You're a professional athlete. But with what's going on now, is football really kind of secondary in your mind?
Yeah, for now, my mind is just past, like, I need to take care of me, of my family. I need to spend a good time, you know, enjoy every moment in the home. And the second part, we have some work to do with the team. So we have a specific program to work out in home. It's like, you know, it's a big difference, but is I think everything is with, if we have every moment with good attitude, we do it good. I think I work out. I enjoy the time when I work out and see my child here, like smiling, like making jokes, and at the same time I work. So it's really good.
He's talking to Darwin Serén of the Houston Dynamo, and that's a great positive attitude, and we all got to stay positive during these times. Darwin, I want to talk to you about El Salvador, and you know, having been to El Salvador myself and in the 80s playing against teams like FAS and Firpo, I learned how important football is in El Salvador. Just talk to me about growing up in El Salvador and the passion the country has for football.
Yes, it's a small country, but we all love soccer in El Salvador. You can feel, I think, when you was there and playing soccer, you feel like the people crazy there, support the team. So it's very, all the people so excited supporting the teams and enjoying soccer. So it's a country like where I grow up and all time playing soccer. My mom and my dad every time bring me to the fields and playing soccer with my brother. Actually, my brother play professional too. We play together in the national team too. I think it's amazing country. You know, it's the people love soccer. That's something that we love too. We do to play. So every time when we are there, so if we had the opportunity to spend time with the people there, every time I enjoy it because they have a good concept of me, of my family. So I'm very happy to have a time with all our community in El Salvador too.
To be the captain of El Salvador, I mean, that is an incredible honor. When I say that to you, how does that make you feel?
I never, when I started playing professional in 2009 with my first team, professional, and the second league in El Salvador, it was Juventud Independiente.
Yes.
I never think about, I mean, in my mind, never like talk about maybe some point I go in the national team. I play for my national team. Even I get the captain of the team. So, but happen on the life, you know. If you work hard, if you play like 100% all the time, you make a difference in your team, happen. So I'm very, very happy when in 2014, one of the coach gave me the captain of the team. So I'm very, very excited with that. And then we have a lot of games, important games, and that's I enjoy it. I think I enjoy it the most because my brother play with me too, so it's a very, very good thing of my family.
Yes, I've watched your brother as well, Oscar, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So let me take you into when you were a little boy, outside of your parents, who were the big influences for you from a football perspective? Your big influences football-wise?
Yeah, I think it was my mom and my dad, because all the time they bring me, they never say no when I say, Dad, I want to play soccer, or Mom, I want to play soccer. I need to go someplace to play soccer. They always have the time to me and to my brother to bring us to the some little teams when we are like a kid. And then, they always talk about the school and soccer. So in the house, if, for example, you go after school, you have some homework, you have to do it before you go to the field and practice some soccer with your friends. So was a very difficult for us because we live very, very close to the field. And sometimes, you don't have the same energy to do all the homework in the day. And then we only see with my brother the other friends walking to in front of us, walking to the field, and then we want to go. But my mom always was there and say, you finish your homework, you can go. If not, you can stay home. So it's one moment like always appreciate for my mom because they always take care of us. And then, we follow our dreams. All the time we want to play soccer, we watch soccer in the home, and then we always talking with my brother, like, maybe at some point we go and play professional, but we have to work. We have to work hard, and then the opportunity is coming, and that's why we do it professional now.
Talking to the Houston Dynamo's Darwin Serrani, he's also the captain of El Salvador. How did you get discovered and then come to the United States in the USL in Orlando, Darwin?
Yeah, I remember when we qualified to playoff in El Salvador, and actually we play again fast in Santa Ana. We play away. And Gonzalo Clavijo, who is my agent now, he was in El Salvador with Adrian Heath, the Minnesota coach.
Yes.
So they go there because, Orlando got the expansion. Orlando was the 2015, they got the spot in the expansion team. And 2014, when I came here to Orlando, they play in USL. But they are starting making the team to 2015 for your first season in MLS. So when they came here, they came to El Salvador, they actually go for another player, not for me. They go for a forward because we have a Uruguayan guy. And he scored a lot of goals with our team. And my agent was his agent too. But when they are there, this guy, the forward, he talk about me, about my brother, and about other play that they need to be focused on, and us too, because he say this guy are very good too. So they... Maybe you can see.
So they saw you. They saw you, even though they were looking for another player, and signed you.
Yes, that's a funny part because when we talk, because we have a meeting after the game, team. I remember we played Saturday night, and they are in the stadium watching the game.
Wow, it's a great, great story.
And then Sunday in the morning, 10 a.m. in the morning, we had a meeting, and they start talking like, "Ah, oh, we're here. I'm Adrian Heath. I'm the coach for Orlando City team. We are the USL, and then next year we go to MLS first league in the U.S. All these things, and then we come here to watch Toscanini is the name of the forward. It's Uruguayan.
But in the end, they get Darwin. They get Darwin Seren. Darwin, we have to go. We're on a hard break. There's only 30 seconds left in the show. Thank you so much for coming on the program tonight. We're glad you're in Houston with the Houston Dynamo. Stay safe with your family, and we'll see you soon. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the... Stay safe, great. Too, and all the family horror fans, too.
Thank you, Darwin. That's great stuff there from Darwin Serena of the Houston Dynamo. Great way to finish it up tonight. Thank you for listening in. Big thank you to Nick Sharara for filling in, producing here tonight. For all of you who listened in, our guests, Doug Wren, Mike Cohen, my nephew Con, and Darwin Serena. We thank you tonight. Podcastarena.com, iTunes. That's where you get the podcast of this show. Good night, everyone.